Thank you all for coming. It's really great to see that so many people are interested in web performance optimization and now automation. So I'm going to give you a brief outline of what I'm going to talk about today. And yeah, I hope that it suits your needs. Otherwise, there's going to be a Q&A at the end. And because the web is so versatile and we have so many tools to work with, I hope we can solve specific problems that you might have then. And I hope that I can tackle most of them during my talk. But let's see. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is a private little story of automation failure. Because the anecdote, and it highlights a lot of the problems that we might encounter when automating systems. Talk that automation brings with it and highlight some things how to deal with that. And then we'll have a look at several automation tools, web performance automation tools. And later on, it will become clear why I'm also going to talk about testing tools then, because that's something that should go hand in hand. So who of you knows very well why we should care about web performance? Please raise your hand. That's me. Who else? So. Okay, that's hard. It's gonna be it's like 50-50. So I'm not sure. I'm gonna spend like 1 minute talking about it, okay, and then I'll move on. So what I brought you here is a graph that shows the Alexa top 2000 stats over time. I from several sources and yeah, cleaned up the stats, and what came out is this. What you see here is bounces. You all know bounce rate from websites. And abandonments. Now, lots of people ask me, what are abandonments? Abandonments is when a potential customer comes to a site and is so annoyed by the experience that he leaves and doesn't come back within a period of 6 weeks or more. So that's a hard number. So as you can see, as websites become slower, these graphs rise really, really quickly. And there's the so-called performance deadland, wasteland, where you shouldn't really be bothering about optimizing your site, just throw it away and build a new one. Then try to get better in here. That's like from here to here. And then this is the nirvana, basically. This is the 1.3 seconds, which is the magic number that Google is always going for, or the 1 second time to glass that Ilya Grigorik speaks about. So these are the you want to go to, but most pages in the past are somewhere around here, like 6-point-something seconds. So if you can use graphs, you see that people get annoyed with websites and they leave them. So this is the reason why we should care. Okay? So I hope now you're all on the page why we should care. So next, I'd love to talk about how we, in my former company, try to solve this problem, try to create a new website that services the needs of our customers, and how we failed. So at the beginning, when we started working for this company, we encountered a very, very interesting infrastructure. Basically, there was a huge amount of very many websites, and there was basically no system to it. Like whoever decided, oh, we need a new web server, somebody bought a machine for that, or set up a virtual machine for that, and then they put on whatever they wanted, whatever CMS they wanted. No, they didn't care about the hardware specs or how to maintain them in the future. They just created it, put it on. And so there was a very heterogeneous system. Very, very many websites we encountered. And the reason why we were called there in the first place, it was because stats were dropping across the board for all major websites of this company. So we thought, okay, let's relaunch them. But what we had to consider when we decided how to relaunch were these kinds of traffic spikes. Because the company had an interesting habit of publishing things like once a year or twice a year. And when they did that, press and customers hit the site, so we had these kinds of traffic spikes. And so the system we were to create to deal with these problems. It had to destroy this heterogeneous system that we had encountered, try to make it more performant, more manageable, and it had to deal with these kinds of traffic spikes. So what we came up with was a high performance server stack. We created we tackled Varnish, which was then by version 3, just released, really very, very cool. We set our system up on Nginx because it was so high-performed and we just loved it, and it's very, very good for static files. And because lots of the sites were running WordPress, we had to enable Nginx to understand PHP, so we went with the FPM wrapper. We included several layers of caching, as you can see. One for PHP was APC, because by then PHP was supposed to include APC natively in version 6 point something. This is now out again, so this is outdated. I think they have now created an own opcode cache for PHP. And because it's WordPress, we also had to deal with MySQL, and we had caching on MySQL as well. So this is the high-performance server stack recreated. And after testing that properly and deploying it on the live side, we decided this is a good stack, we can deal with that. So what we did is we cloned it. We built a virtual machine for it, and we just cloned it. Whenever we launched a new website, we just cloned that thing because we could rely on that. That's what you're supposed to do, right? Have a system you understand and use it over and over again. So, but the trouble was that, as you all know probably, web performance optimization isn't really happening on the server side. It's happening in the front end. Like Steve Sauter says, web performance optimization is more than 80% front end optimization. So we had to understand how to optimize the front end. So we looked at what makes up a website, and as you can see, it's a mess. I mean, there's images coming in from your website, from third-party content. There's videos mostly from third-party providers. There's JavaScript relying on JavaScript. There is external Flash as fallback, even now in 2013. Then there's cascades of CSS. And then there's monitoring tools, which also slow down your site. This is a very, very funny thing. Normally, you should think monitoring tools, uptime stuff, and all like that doesn't affect the site at all. But depending on how badly it's built, it really does. So we had to consider all these things and find out how can we optimize this website. To understand where to start, we went to the HTTP archive, also created by Steve Sauters, and checked out where we could get the highest ROI, so the highest return on investment, where to start optimizing our websites. And the takeaways are the images in a website have the highest correlation to page load time, because they are like more than 60% of every website out there, and they're so big and most people don't optimize them properly. And images are also creating many HTTP requests. So second, reduce HTTP requests, also then for CSS, JavaScript, and other assets. And then the third thing that is very, very important but isn't shown on this graphs is improve the caching, because even if you optimize everything, lots and lots of servers are still poorly configured, and no matter how often the customer visits the site, he still doesn't get any benefit from having cached anything. So configure your caching headers. These are the three things we implemented, or basically we implemented even more than that, of course. But that was basically how we decided to work on the website and make it fast. And when we implemented all that, our website, we had 11 HTTP requests and was loading in less than 1.3 seconds. So we thought, excellent, we made it. And then we launched, and we failed. Because what we forgot was performance regressions. We were thinking about this website, this major website, as a one-time product. Build it once, create it once, ship it, and then go party. But the truth is, of course, a website is a living thing, right? There's new images coming in, new articles being posted by people who are not web developers. So what happened over time was people uploaded unoptimized images. They included, what was that, WordPress plugins that slowed down our site. They did all these terrible things which we didn't think about. So we thought, okay, we should probably think about automating these processes, especially image optimization, all that stuff. So the question really was, can automation come to our rescue? And after some time, I had to realize, no, there's a huge problem with automation. The problem with automation is that it is unreliable. You don't really know if something went well when you automate things. It's like a black box. You create this thing, and you hope that it always runs. That's what most developers do, right? You think, oh my god, this is a tedious task. I really, really want to automate this. So you create something like a bash script, or you just download your news grunt something, and you automate things, but then you tend to forget and you don't really understand how it works, and you tend to forget how to check if there's actually happening what you want this automation system to do for you. So you know this this threading joke that was on Twitter, I think, a couple of months back. This thing, a programmer had a problem and he thought to himself, I know I'll solve it with now. Now too, he has something. You know, remember that joke? This is basically adapted for automation. He, you know, I'll solve it with automation. Now he has 2 2 2 2 2 out of memory, because that's what happens if you don't monitor automation systems. They just break on you someday. So if you take one thing away from this talk today, please let it be that you can't just automate things and go away. The lesson number one is automation and testing, monitoring, should always go hand in hand. So when we think about an ideal system, really dreamland system, that if where automation could take place, it would hopefully look something like this. There is a dev environment where the people actually work on things. Oh no, let me start on something else. In an ideal environment, people on the dev environment would work on the state of the life site. So they don't work on something completely artificial that has anything to do with the content happening on the life site. So step one should always be take the state from the life server and give it to the devs so they have a proper system to work upon that reflects well on the actual content of the later life site. When that is done, people work on the dev environment and they have their unit tests, right? They program new stuff in, and then they initiate an automation system like optimizing images, concatenating JavaScript and CSS, minifying HTML, and then it gets pushed to a staging server, and this staging server is also ideal world. A perfect copy of the live system. So hardware is identical here. I know this is always a problem in real world environments, but in my last company we actually managed to get our CEO to agree on this, so we bought two of everything. Because that's really nice. If you do load testing and stuff and you know the hardware here is identical to that, that really helps. So when a developer has started the automation process and everything went well, it's on a staging system. What should happen then is that a set of testing, of auditing tools sets in and tests if all the automated stuff that's now deployed on the system is actually the way it's supposed to be. Like, is there actually only one CSS file now? Are all images optimized and ideally don't they lack artifacts? They don't have any artifacts in them from compression. Is the JavaScript unified now? Does the JavaScript still work after unification, all that stuff? So when this is done, there's two possibilities. One is, yay, everything works, when we can deploy. Or we can't, so let's go back from scratch. And then the live only has the normal monitoring tools like Uptime and Google Analytics or Pivik or whatever you have. It doesn't really audit the files anymore. So this is, from my perspective, a nice setup of how to make sure that when you automate things, you also monitor things properly and make sure that your automation doesn't mess up your site. So identical systems here, they work on the state from the live server. This thing monitors if this thing did its job. That's the basic idea. What I already explained with this schematic is also very, very well caught by John Holzbach from Etsy, who basically says that we should have a core relationship with automation, because it might just break on us. It might just be dangerous to our site, so we really have to think carefully on how to operate with automation. Let's leverage the synergy of automation and testing. To judge if an automation system is within a realm of acceptable risk or not, John Allspaugh also did some research. I think it's called a moderate approach to automation 1 and 2. And this is one of the tables he gave us. And basically what you have is the LOA, the level of automation from 1 to 10. And as you can see, level 1 is basically no automation at all. It's just the computer sits there and does nothing. And level 10 on the other side is the computer does whatever it wants. It doesn't interact with the human during the operation process at all. Everything in between is a step-by-step process that gets more disconnected from the human operator. So this is a one guideline that I'd like you to remember, this 1 to 10 thing, because we're going to come back to that in a couple of minutes. And then he also gave us this. This is a four-step process, for which within each step there is this 1 to 10, this 1 to 10 schematic again. So we have a 1 to 10 here, and we have four steps of an automated process running. This is information acquisition, information analysis, decision selection, and action implementation. So the process goes about finding out what can I do, finding the assets to optimize. Then it makes proper decisions or improper decisions also on what to do with these assets that it just found. And then there's this last step of actually doing it. And within each of these steps, you can judge how much human interaction is required or how much human interaction makes sense. So the first thing I want to show you of how to automate web performance optimization and judge it by these LoA tables is mod page speed, or page speed in general by Google. What you see here is a schematic of mod page speed is integrated into Apache. Mod page speed is basically a one size fits all fire and forget solution that is supposed to always work. The nice thing about mod page speed for Apache is really you can install it with, I think, 3 lines of code, and its core filter set is quite safe. So they really did a nice job there. And how it works is it basically is an input-output filter. It takes an incoming request from a user, checks is every asset that is required to ship the current page to this user already optimized? Do I have it in my cache? If yes, it ships its already primed cache with optimized assets. If it's not, it optimizes the asset by a set of semi-smart rules. And then it ships the asset and caches the asset for future use. This is how it works. Mod page speed is for Apache, but there's also Nginx page speed, which has to be compiled by hand because Nginx does not allow modules to be loaded. Or you could go, if you really love Nginx and you don't want to compile it from hand, there's also a Chinese fork from Nginx called Tengen, which allows modular loading. And you can use mod page speed with Tengen. And you don't have to compile Nginx from hand, which is, depending on what you do, complicated. So mod page speed is a one-size-fits-all solution. That means it tries to do everything, right? It tries to optimize images. It tries to concatenate. It also, which is really nifty, it also tries to do something like progressive enhancement. So if there's a very modern browser coming along that can handle things like WebP or WebM, stuff like, WebP, right? The new image format by Google, which is like 25% more efficient than what we have with JPEG right now. It decides if the client can actually handle WebP and ships it accordingly. It's actually quite a difficult thing to decide. And mod PageSpeed takes all that work off you. The trouble with this one-size-fits-all solution is, of course, how to check if it actually did its job, right? I mean, that's complicated. So I will talk about how to test these things in a couple of minutes. So let's see how mod PageSpeed ranks within these LoA rankings I just showed you. With information acquisition, it's an 8, which translates to it's automatic and only informs the operator, so the human, if it's so configured. Normally it wouldn't say anything, but if you configure it to something into STD out, pipes anything into STD out, or write you an email, it can do that. Same goes with information analysis. And then there is a distinction between core filters and extended filters. The core filters are things like optimize images and minify HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. And because those are very, very safe things, you can enable them and you can be pretty sure that nothing on your website breaks. But extended filters are things like JavaScript concatenation, which might, depending on which kind of library you're using, break your system. Or it also does things like Zopfli and, I don't know, very, very advanced stuff that might break your site. So they put that into a separate filter set. So you can enable core filters safely, which are also on by default if you install mod PageSpeed, but you have to manually decide to which extended filters to include. You can just run Mod PageSpeed without including any extended filters, but you can enable them one by one if you wanted to. So that's why the extended filter set ranks 3 instead of everything else that ranks 8. It just narrows down the selection of possible actions. That means if you go into the Mod PageSpeed config file and select which extended filters you want to run. So this is how PageSpeed would rank in John Allspar's table. Not to be so theoretically all the time, I also brought you something. I created a virtual machine, and on this virtual machine I created a LAMP stack, and on this LAMP stack I installed Mod PageSpeed. And I also needed some dummy content, and I needed something that's quite realistic, so I set up a WordPress site. I used a couple of plugins to create dummy content, and I put in all the awful stuff that we know from stuff from WordPress, like social plugins that load third-party content, unoptimized images, bad text, wrong HTML, all that stuff is in there. So it reflects a site that might be run by somebody who doesn't know about optimization. And when we test, oh, by the way, who doesn't know about HAR? Anybody who is not familiar with this kind of thing? Okay, HAR views are basically these water diagrams that show you as and how fast they loaded and things like DNS request and how long it had to wait for the server. So there, I put a link in there. This is good. Learn about HAR, which links to a blog post by Ilya Gegurek from Google, who has a very, very nice video in there explaining everything you need to know about HAR. So if you want to know more about HAR, this link. So this is the HAR view of the unoptimized site I just showed you, this blog. So what you can see here is that there's a lot of third-party CSS, JavaScript, and images being loaded. And it has a terrible footprint. This is the onload event, the DOM event on 5.4 seconds. And I think the entire page, because it also loads stuff with AJAX, this is an AJAX slider, is finished by 11 something. So it's not even, there it is. It's still on the slide, but I didn't expect it to be because it's so far to the right. So this is where the page actually finishes rendering. This is an unoptimized site, and now I enabled Mod PageSpeed. And what happens is that it rearranges all that stuff, it compresses everything, and the DOM event fires at 1.3 seconds. As you can see, the page complete, the final event, is still where it was in the first unoptimized version, but this is because of all the AJAX stuff that is loaded afterwards, and Mod PageSpeed cannot do anything about third-party content, right? But it can optimize everything that is on your site. So this is what it did, and the result is quite nice. I mean, this is a combined set of core filters and some extended filters I implemented. And I think, considering that this took me half an hour, this is a nice result, right? Okay. The nice thing about Mod PageSpeed is also you can include it into very, very different setups. You don't always have to use Apache, like I already said, and you don't even have to rely on it to be the communicator in front of your entire stack. I created some graphics that show how you implement Mod PageSpeed into your PageSpeed into your site. This is an Apache running PHP and Mod PageSpeed and MySQL the static. This is a very, very simple thing. Then Nginx with Nginx PageSpeed and basically the high-performance stack I showed you earlier. And then this is Mod PageSpeed as basically a proxy in front of everything else. So that's another setup that's possible. Or you could also put it later in your stack. So Mod PageSpeed isn't just created to sit in front of everything, but you can include it into a variety of stacks you might already be running. So that's very nice. But Mod PageSpeed isn't the only one that can take a lot of load off your tasks, because like I said, it's a black box and you might want to have more control. In the last couple of years, Node.js stuff and stuff like Grunt has become very, very interesting for developers. So I also put in a list of Grunt modules that basically, aside from loading stuff like WebP, do the same thing that Mod PageSpeed can do. So for JavaScript, for example, you have the Grunt Closure Compiler and Uglify.js and a concatenator. CSS can also be concatenated and minified. For images, there's image optim as a grunt task. Then there's a grunt module that can convert an image into 4, so it can be inlined into CSS. You can use Montage. You know Montage from Image Magic, I hope. You can use Grunt Montage to create sprites for and save HTTP requests when shipping images. And then there's an HTML compressor. Then there's a single point of failure check Grunt module. And then Matthias Burns also created the Zopfli implemented into Grunt. So you can basically create most of the stuff that Mod PageSpeed can do also with Grunt. How many of you are using Grunt right now? Oh, okay. Wow. Thought this would be more. Okay. So Grunt is a task runner. Sorry if I lost you there. Grunt is a task runner based on JavaScript that can run tasks for you when you deploy stuff. Okay? So you use Grunt to automate the optimization tasks. So you don't have to run everything manually every time you want to deploy your website. That's what Grunt is for. And that's the evil Grunt. Okay, then you don't even have to rely on Node.js or Grunt to do your work. For most CMSs or content generators today, there are modules that do basically everything I've been talking about. I've been using Middleman in the last couple of months because I really, really enjoy it. Middleman has all the stuff I just talked about available as modules. So you can just install these modules and have Middleman optimize all your assets when you deploy your site. Same holds true for Jekyll, used by GitHub. Icon is a Python implementation of basically the same static file. And then even for CMSs or blog platforms like WordPress or Typo3, there are plugins who do most of the basic optimization tasks nowadays. The interesting thing really now is to think about, wow, okay, we have all these tools, but let's not forget about testing, because automation of the whole thing. We really should be also thinking about how can we test that everything we try to automate also works and isn't broken. So another AllSpark quote, I think. The key element is that whoever has to work with automation is also able to fix the system, fix the assets if they get broken during the automation process. And the interesting question is, what is failure then? Because we might have to think about what we actually want to measure when we test our automation system. Think about unit tests for a minute. Who has implemented unit tests? Yay, cool, that's great. Thank you, good job. Unit tests make you realize that your code is crap, right? You write your code, then you implement unit tests. So ideally, you write unit tests while you write your code. But the truth is, most of us write unit tests after. So when I write code and later I write unit tests, what happens is I start realizing, oh my god, the function I've written is terrible. So I have to split it up into several functions so I can make them testable. And the key element of this train of thought is I need integer, one decimal number, whatever, that I can unit test, right? I need one result per unit test. So I can be sure that everything's working. Same holds true for testing if your automation process works. So you have unit tests on the one end, and you might think of these things as integration tests if you would like to. So to test if your automation process actually worked and didn't break anything, there's a lot of tools out there that can do a lot of the hard lifting nowadays. I brought you a list of Node.js plugins and PhantomJS plugins. PhantomJS is a headless WebKit browser which can take a lot of the work off you. So one of the things I really love that has been debated in the last couple of months is a visual regression tester. Basically, what this tool does is it has a screenshot of a site in its cache, and when the site gets created or recreated, it takes another screenshot and visually compares the elements. It visually compares the visual state before and after, basically makes an overlay, and the algorithm finds out, oh my god, something has changed, you broke something. This is a very, very nice thing. Of course, it will throw errors if you actually change the CSS. But it's a nice test to see if your CSS is still valid after you unified it, after you minified and unified everything. Because it might be that your automated CSS concatenator broke your cascade. so your CSS would be messed up. You would still have one CSS file, one unified gzipped glorified CSS file, but your page would look crap. So the only way to test that is to actually have a computer test your image of, this is how the website is supposed to look, this is how the website looks now, and then create an alert to a human if something went wrong. So Phantom CSS is a very, very nice tool for that. Then if you just, I've actually been meeting with a couple of companies and the only thing they measure is their time to first byte or their total load speed. That's the only thing they measure. I find this frightening, honestly. If you only want to do that for, if you only want to do that for the beginning, there are nice tools called load speed or Basset. Load speed just gives you one decimal number, just like your website took 1.7 seconds to load. And Basset is Basset can run like 10 of these tests and then create a median number for that. So you have a less monotonous number to test. But yet again, just testing for the total page load time isn't a great way to see if your automation really worked, right? Because it just isn't one number. You can see if it went up or down, but it is just one number to test, so that doesn't really help us a lot. What might help us is actually grabbing full HTTP headers, and you can do that in Node.js or Phantom.js with NetSniff. And it gives you a JSON of all the HTTP headers that Phantom.js created when it crawled the website, when it opened the website. And then you can check on things like, has the file size of my unified CSS changed? Or has it grown? Is it getting smaller? You can basically, for every asset, if you know that the asset is there, you can check this and check it against a database of numbers and see if everything is still within parameters. It's also available as Phantom.js is WebKit-based. It's also available for Slimer.js, which is Gecko. So you basically can even run two tests on two different browser engines to get the same result and compare it with your database. I still don't think that this is a very, very nice approach because as soon as one element changes, as soon as you get one new element in your site, you would have to change the entire test stack. So this is quite complicated. What I also have been testing in the past is basically HTTP perf and Node Unit, which gives you a complete testing framework. So you don't only get the numbers back, but you also have the entire logic of numbers are valid or not. So basically like a unit test framework. This is what HTTP perf and Node Unit does for you. Might work. I still think it's too unspecific. What I really, really like is the base, or I don't really know how to pronounce it, if that is best base or whatever the author thought about this. He put a speaker icon in, so I think it's supposed to be re-pronounced base. So let's go with base. Base can test a lot of things and is very smart about this. So it's also quite like a unit testing framework, but you can basically test anything. You can even test things like the first H1 in the site I just tested contains the words magnificent and magniflorious, but none of the words is longer than 20 characters. You can write tests like this. So it's very powerful, but also very complicated. What I would prefer right now is a approach that is taken by Phantomas, Phantom.js based web performance monitoring tool. And what this gives you is a set of, I think, about 80 predefined metrics you can check and test against your data. You want to make sure that your page doesn't exceed. Like Phantomas gives you data like the fastest HTTP response was, the slowest HTTP response was, this and this number or percentile of assets has been gzipped or not. These are things that Phantomas gives you. So this is like a opinionated web performance testing tool, and I tend to agree with the creator, so that's why I like it. So if you want to check for a tool that is powerful enough but not too complicated, like some of the tools I just showed you before, check out Phantomas. It's really nice. the king and queen, basically, of web performance testing is, of course, still web page test and HTTP archive. Web page test is created by Pat Meehan from Google, and what it gives you is a proper server client architecture for testing all modern browsers. Who of you has been using web page test in the past? Oh, okay. So web page test automates browsers by putting plugins into them, and they retrieve data from the browser. So very, very modern browsers already give the user access to all the data they generate, but not all, especially Internet Explorer doesn't. So Pat Meehan and his crew created plugins so that all modern browsers return metrics that can be used to monitor things. So you have a server that takes all the data that the clients running the browsers obtain, and then you can get HAR views from it. It can export JSON. You can also use HAR export to put your HAR files into a database and compare them. You can run all the JSON returned elements against your own testing framework. So that's really nice because, like I told you before, well, PhantomJS and Slammer.js are just WebKit headless and Gecko headless. So these are not real browsers, if you want to say it like that. But WebPageTest is contains IE 7 to 10, even some older versions of Opera and stuff like that. So that's very, very nice and powerful. The thing is, of course, setting something like this up is complicated. You need Windows server licenses, which is annoying, and you need Windows client licenses to run the clients. For Internet Explorer, you are not supposed to run more than one instance of Internet Explorer on one machine, so if you want to test with more than one version of Internet Explorer, you would need a Windows license for every single version, which can be expensive. So if you want to set up a private testing instance of web page test, this might cost you money, but it is the best and most professional way to do so. Okay, cool. Then a nifty thing I've been working on the last couple of months is image optimization. I mean, we can test things like, has our CSS size grown, or has it gotten smaller? How many HTTP requests are we making, right? These are just numbers. We can compare one number to another and see if our automation process has actually worked. The problem with images is you don't really can judge if the image optimization process has worked properly with a single number, or at least I'm going to give you one single number later. But it's quite complicated to test if an image has actually been properly, because you can't just go by file size. If you go by file size, what might happen is that you get artifacts in the image. And one of the most complained things I've been hearing about in companies is, oh my God, I have uploaded an image to my CMS and now it looks shitty, right? Now it has artifacts because the CMS has implemented some sort of image compression, and now the user sees artifacts, and the editor who just uploaded the picture, they don't get it. They don't know about image compression and why there are artifacts in their pretty JPEG now. So if you want to prevent this and make sure that your automated image compression process doesn't just check for file size and if the image is now smaller than the original, you should check out the SM score. It has been created to follow up on the peak signal to noise ratio, and what it gives you is it compares two images to each other, one before and one after, and checks how much they have changed. So I don't think we can see this on the screen here, but this is the original image, and this is an image compressed by JPEG Mini. JPEG Mini is an Israeli company, also bought by Google, who implemented a very, very nifty image compression technique. They use saliency algorithms to detect stuff within the image and compress unimportant parts of the image. And what happens is that granular stuff like these waves and the sand gets compressed by JPEG Mini, and artifacts are appearing all over the place. You have little artifacts here, so the file size could be reduced. JPEG Mini does a really good job in reducing but it creates artifacts, and this is what annoys users. What you could do is run an SM test on the image before your optimization process and after your optimization process, and see if the SM score is above or below a certain threshold you might have to configure. And then you can basically judge by one number if your image optimization automation process is working fine or not. So that's a very nifty thing, I think. If I had to sum up the takeaways I would love you guys to take out of this talk is automation and testing, they go together, okay? Don't just think, I can optimize things, I can do less work manually, and forget about testing, because sooner or later things will break. So you might think about testing automated processes now to make sure they will, if they break, you know when and what to do. Then if you start implementing web optimization automation processes, start with the areas yielding the highest ROI. So start with image optimization, because that's something a lot of people still don't do on their websites. And then start with things like reducing HTTP requests. And then last thing, when the testing framework you're implementing to check if your automation works fires an alert. This is a very funny thing. Make sure the people who get woken up in the middle of the night because the automation process broke are the people who are able to fix that, because that's actually something that lots of companies get wrong. Like somebody else from a completely different department gets called in the middle of the night and he goes like, I don't know how to fix that, go away. So make sure the people who get the alerts are actually the people able to fix the automated build process. Okay, these are the three things I would love you guys to take away from this talk. So thank you all for listening. I hope it has been. And yeah, because web performance optimization is such a diverse field and we have so many tools and so many platforms to work upon, I think it would be a great time for us to have a Q&A now. So if you guys have questions, I'd love to answer them. Yes. Because people are, the question is, why don't the developers test, right? Is that the summary? Why don't the developers test if things worked? Okay, answer A is automation tends to think that people are unreliable, so they tend to forget, and I don't agree 100%. I don't think we're replaced by robots, but I think under stress it's still true. If there's a release date, if something is supposed to be published, web developers are the first ones to be shouted at because they're at the bottom of the line, so they're the first ones to tend to forget things. So if you automate, you might be able to prevent forgetting that you might need to optimize your assets. Yes, the developer, on the other hand, the developer is the perfect person to judge if an optimization process has actually worked. You're completely right there. Thing is, again, that people don't scale, right? If you have a huge website and there's thinking of websites that have like 40 commits or 40 pushes to live a day, you can't really expect web developers to do that. I mean, there's entire testing departments for some companies doing nothing but that, but it's a tedious job, and I think that if we defined a proper system of automation and testing, we might take a lot of work off these people's shoulders, have them focus on complicated stuff.
I think the question was not about doing it manually as a developer or automating it as a server, but automating it, but more doing it in terms of within a deployment process, in a build process, or doing it on a production machine type of thing.
But that's actually a very good point. The trouble with Mod PageSpeed is, of course, it doesn't deploy anywhere. It runs on your live machine, as it runs hopefully then on your staging machine because you have identical setups. But yeah, that's a very good point. Mod PageSpeed is this black box, right? You install it and you hope that it does the right thing because you configured it that way, but you don't really have any control over it because all the assets are in its asset cache, and the asset cache is a black box, so all you can do is test what comes out of it. Yes.
How do you test mobile devices?
How do you test? Well, that's a. Yes, you can actually you can hook up not all devices, but you can hook up certain devices with ModPage with web page test clients. Getting proper testing data from mobile devices is still a complicated thing. There are people working on a couple of projects, but I think the most promising thing we can wait on now is navigation timing and resource timing by W3C, because we can't really force the mobile vendors to give us access to everything. Most of them have given developers access to some resources, but I think, yes, iOS, obviously. iOS is not doing that. Safari hasn't implemented anything yet, so debugging mobile Safari is still tricky. Automating testing on mobile is even more tricky, I think. So best we can do is hope that in 2 or 3 years' time, resource timing has been implemented in all modern browsers, even on mobile devices, and we can then hook into resource timing, I think. There's no silver bullet for that right now. Sorry. True. Yeah, it might be possible. The thing is, of course, they don't return real-world data, but then if you compare one not real-world data to another, that still works. So. Yes. It isn't automatable, but Steve Sauders created a mobile bookmarklet for all the browsers that don't give you proper testing tools. I mean, you can hook up several mobile devices these days with USB and then get debugging data from the browser via USB. Is it ADP? I don't know the protocol. Anyway, there's this bookmarklet which you can use to waterfall diagrams and HAR files from mobile devices. You can just, if you don't know, if you haven't seen that yet, you can check that out because it works on most mobile devices I've seen. I have very little experience with with web-based tools that do that. I know that Pingdom has a lot of tools that try to cover some of these things. And then there's the very new one that was Velocity this year, Speed Test or something, that's also based on web page test but gives it a nice web front GUI. But I haven't checked that out yet. It's still in beta. You can request a key, I think. Oh, cool. Excellent, thank you. Oh yeah, please repeat the question, I always forget that. If nobody else has questions, thank you all for coming and caring about web performance.